From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Let's get the latest from Washington, where it appears a government shutdown is likely to happen tonight. NPR congressional reporter Scott Detrow joins us from Washington. Scott, what's the latest?
Well, the latest is that we've learned that President Trump has invited Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer to the White House for a one-on-one meeting. We were told that meeting would be happening shortly. It might even be happening right now. We don't know for sure, but Trump and Schumer are meeting. And given the way that Trump will get in a room with Democrats and agree to what they say and get in a room with Republicans and agree to what they say, a lot of Republicans in Congress are pretty nervous about the idea of Trump and Schumer figuring something out together.
What could they figure out that could avoid a shutdown? Because hasn't the House already been given the ability to leave town at this point? So basically, the Senate would have to accept what the House passed, right?
Yes and no. The House said that. That was a bit of brinksmanship. But House members have been warned that they should be prepared to return to Washington imminently for votes. Not clear how quickly they could get back together. And here's the other thing. If Trump and Schumer got to some sort of agreement and said, OK, we'll vote for the CR, we'll vote to keep the government open on the promise of doing X, Y, and Z early next week, it'd be hard for a lot of Democrats to buy that, given the fact that President Trump so quickly changes his mind, especially on this issue.
Is it possible that there will be some resolution on the issue of the Dreamers, the people brought here illegally as children who are going to be deported if nothing gets done?
I mean, that is the key issue right now. Democrats want to see increased domestic spending as well, but this government could shut down mostly because of the fact that Democrats are angry at the president and Republicans for not resolving DACA yet, not agreeing to something that would give permanent protection for the 700,000 or so people in that program.
And if there is a shutdown, this would be the first time it's ever happened with one party controlling all three of the branches.
That's right. And that's why Democrats feel confident that President Trump would be the one taking the blame for this. But so far, the White House has been pretty persistent calling this the Schumer shutdown, right, saying if it happens, it's because of Democrats.
NPR congressional reporter Scott Detrow. Scott, thank you.
Thanks. Talk to you soon.
And joining us now is Congressman Jim Jordan, who's a Republican from Ohio. Congressman, welcome to you.
Good to be with you.
And is there going to be a shutdown tonight?
You'd have to ask the senators that. That's in over in their side of the Congress right now. So you'd have to talk to Chuck Schumer and see if that's going to happen. But it seems to be they want to not fund our military and close down the government because they think a bad immigration policy, amnesty is more important than funding the troops and keeping the government open.
So you think it's amnesty to allow the Dreamers, people who were brought here illegally as children, to stay in the country?
I think it's wrong to make that the issue that is comes first, because I don't think that's consistent with what the election was about in 2016. I think it was pretty clear that the election was about, on the immigration issue, it was about border security wall, it was about ending chain migration, it was about sanctuary cities, it was about the visa lottery, it was about E-Verify, it was about those border security and security issues that were front and center. So that's got to be the focus of immigration policy, and that's certainly not the focus of Democrats who are saying, we're going to shut down the government, we're not going to pay the troops, because we think it's more important to make DACA and amnesty the priority versus security when it comes to immigration.
How can you make the case, though, that the Democrats are at fault, given that the Republicans control the White House, the House, and the Senate right now?
You know how it works, right? You know how it works. It's a crazy rule, and I'm for getting rid of it, but you know how it works is the crazy 60-vote rule in the Senate. You got to have Democrats support something to get it passed, which is just—it's ridiculous. But it's the fact. So when Democrats aren't willing to do what they all voted for, I mean, they all voted to fund the military. A couple months ago, we passed the National Defense Authorization legislation, which set the military spending at a certain level, and now they're not even willing to go there unless they get more spending and they get amnesty for folks who came to this great country in a legal way.
So you think Democrats are going to be blamed if there's a shutdown?
I'm not worried about blame. I'm worried about doing what the American people sent us here to do. So you can blame whoever you want, and you guys probably will blame Republicans, but I that's not my focus. I think we make the job too complicated. What was the election about? What did we tell the American people we were going to do? They then elected us and sent us here to accomplish certain objectives, certain policy goals. let's do that. And I know they did not say, I mean, they what Dick Durbin wants, what Chuck Schumer wants is, oh, let's do a DACA amnesty legislation, and then maybe we'll do a little security along with it. But that's not what the election about. The election was about doing all the security things I just talked about, doing all those, and then, okay, we're going to make sure we address the situation with these 700 folks who came here, 700,000 folks who came here illegally.
You're a founding member of the Freedom Caucus, which doesn't like doing these short-term extensions. Why were you willing to go along with this one?
Well, you're right. We don't like them, and I've voted against a lot of them in the past. I voted for some that I thought strategically made some sense. We made the calculation last night that we would vote for this one. You know, we've got some commitments from leadership to do certain things that we think are going to be helpful if they follow through on those commitments, which we hope they do. Then I think we're going to get some better policy. But you're right. I think it's bad to lurch from short-term spending bill to short-term spending bill, particularly for our national defense. But we did. The vast majority of our members supported it last night.
Are you leaving town today, or are you staying?
I've got a flight scheduled for late tonight, but I'm staying the rest of the day because of the pro-life march here in town. We got a number of pro-life groups and families from Ohio who will be stopping by our reception.
But you're not going to stay in case there's another vote needed in the House to avoid a shutdown?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, again, it depends on what the Senate does. If I need to stay, I'll stay. But I just don't know.
That's Jim Jordan, a Republican congressman from Ohio. Thank you so much for joining us.
You bet, brother. Take care.
All right, let's hear how this story and others are playing out on social media. Brittany Levine Beckman is an associate editor at Mashable. Hi, Brittany.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Doing well, thanks. Look, Republicans are trying to blame this potential shutdown that could be coming later tonight on Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. They're using the hashtag Schumer Shutdown.
Yeah, they are. And I would say that Democrats are using the hashtag Trump Shutdown. So you have the two sides of the political spectrum fighting on Twitter with their own individual hashtags, trying to blame each other for the shutdown. So you have the Democrats saying that it's Trump and the Republicans' fault because the Republicans control two houses of Congress. So how can it be the Democrats' fault? And then you have Republicans saying that all Democrats want to do is shut down the military with the Schumer hashtag.
Right. That's a big part of this debate, and it's obviously going to heat up as we get closer to midnight. Look, another interesting story going on. We mentioned it earlier this week. There's this Google Arts and Culture app. You upload a selfie of yourself. It then uses technology to find a portrait somewhere in a museum of fine art around the world. It's blowing up on people's Facebook and Instagram accounts.
Not only is it blowing up on people's Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram accounts, but now there's sort of been this conversation around people of color have noticed that the app tries to match them with some other ethnicity, as their own isn't well represented within the app. One of my colleagues at Mashable, who's Mexican American, he tried to use the app and it couldn't find a single Mexican to match him with. He was matched with a bunch of old white men or a bunch of Japanese men, and people on Twitter have noticed this too.
Well, and that's interesting because obviously Mexico is home to some of the most famous artists in the world.
Yes, and Google has lots of art in this collection, but a lot of the art focuses on European and Asian art in the library. And, you know, for Google's part, it's continually updating the collection. So we can imagine that eventually perhaps there will be more Mexican and Latino artists, but they're just not there at the moment.
Yeah. This next story, I can't even believe that I'm about to say this, but people are eating laundry detergent.
Yeah, do it.
Did you just eat that?
I'm like, what? People are eating Tide Pods, those colorful laundry detergent packets. What is going on with that?
It is something that has been happening since around Christmas and a little bit before. It's this internet trend, the Tide Pod Challenge. Some people call it the forbidden fruit meme, forbidden snacks. Ugh. It's this idea that these colorful packets of Tide Pods look like candy. They look like gushers. So a bunch of teens and tweens online thought it would be fun, and it began as a prank to challenge each other to eat the forbidden fruit, as they say. But as we know, that forbidden fruit is toxic and poisonous, and there have now been so many videos, not just on social media, but on YouTube, too, that Tide, they have their social media manager now tweeting out to people that if you've eaten a Tide Pod, please contact Poison Control, go to your doctor.
And YouTube is taking those videos down, isn't it?
Yes. So YouTube announced this week and Facebook announced this week that they will be removing the Tide Pod Challenge videos from their platforms. You know, from the teens and tweens that upload those videos, the reaction has been no. From everyone else who thinks this entire thing is absurd, it's been what took them so long.
Everyone else, including me, Brittany Levine Beckman, associate editor at Mashable. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
People, do not eat soap. Please.
Tomorrow marks 1 year since Donald Trump was sworn in as the nation's 45th president. In his 16-minute inaugural address, President Trump promised to reverse what he saw as the nation's decline. His message echoed the broad theme of his campaign, Make America Great Again.
We, the citizens of America, are now joined in a great national effort to rebuild our country and restore its promise for all of our people. Together, we will determine the course of America and the world for many, many years to come.
Joining us now to reflect on Trump's inaugural address is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And a year later, what stands out to you about that inaugural address?
Well, he outlined a pretty bleak vision of the United States, and I don't think it's a vision that's changed. A lot of his policies, a lot of his promises have really built off what he said in the inauguration, an effort to attack, to go after the problems that he thinks diminish what the country is and are at the core of the problems that he sees in front of him.
I was in Washington covering that speech, and what you're saying is what a lot of analysts said that day, that it was a very dark speech. At one point, he listed the problems he saw across the country, people trapped in poverty, rusted out factories, scattered like tombstones, and he continued.
And the crime and the gangs and the drugs that have stolen too many lives and robbed our country of so much unrealized potential. This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
How does that phrase American carnage resonate a year later?
Well, I mean, in some ways you hear him say that and you hear the way he juxtaposes the problems that many Americans face with then the, you know, problems of crime and immigration. And it makes sense given what he's going to do over the coming year. For him, the problems that he saw were always to be blamed on those issues that he lists. That is the source of the American carnage, rather than people needing economic assistance, people needing better kinds of jobs. And so I think you hear that. I listen to that, and I could almost imagine what's to come. He certainly has been consistent, predictable, and fulfilled a lot of the kind of politics that he promised.
Is part of it, though, strategic? And it's about saying that everything is terrible when I started so that no matter what I do, if things get a little bit better, it looks like I did a good job.
There is an element of that. I mean, he was becoming president when conditions were actually starting to improve as a result of President Obama. So there is a strategic element to that. But I'm not sure it's all strategy. I think a lot of this is ideological. This is his worldview. This is how he sees the country. And I think in that speech, whoever wrote it, whether it was Stephen Miller, Stephen Bannon, whoever actually put the kernels of the ideas in there, that really is how he perceives the country. So I don't think the conditions during which he took over really are the reason that he gave that speech. I think that is the way he sees this country.
What is the purpose of an inaugural address for a new president? Is it supposed to be a list of things you want to do?
No, it's not a laundry list of policies. One thing it does is it sets the tone for your presidency. So often presidents use it to set a tone of optimism and get people excited about what's to come. He obviously took it in a different direction. And the second is just to set the beginning of an agenda, to move from the campaign to the phase of governance and to give the country, not just your supporters, a feel for where you're going to be moving. And so this is a stark contrast to John F. Kennedy's famous inaugural speech, where he was really looking to the best that the country had, whereas Donald Trump, then becoming President Trump, was turning our attention to the dangers that we face.
Well, and one of those dangers, in his view, was a corrupt Washington. And he talked about transferring power out of Washington. Here he is.
For too long, a small group in our nation's capital has reaped the rewards of government while the people have borne the cost. Washington flourished, but the people did not share in its wealth. Politicians prospered, but the jobs left and the factories closed. The establishment protected itself, but not the citizens of our country.
Julian, he's talked about draining the swamp. Many people would look at the situation now and say it looks swampier than ever.
That's absolutely true. The arguments he's making there probably would gain a lot of support. There's many people who have been frustrated with Washington in both parties, but we have seen no progress over the year in actually dealing with these kinds of issues. There's been no effort to really reform, for example, campaign finance or the way lobbying works. President Trump has set up enormous conflict of interest problems through his own business and his refusal to really, really separate his own earnings and his own industry from the job of governance. And so the swamp remains in place, if you believe it's a swamp. And it's easy to argue that it's become worse over the course of the year, in large part because of the decisions the administration faced. The good news for President Trump is that his supporters are real believers. And even with the fact that the swamp might be worse, many will feel that he has drained it and that he's made it better, regardless of the facts on the ground.
There were comparisons to Ronald Reagan's inaugural speech in 1981 in what Trump was saying. Did you hear Reagan in the speech?
A little bit. I mean, there was a certain amount of pessimism in Reagan, and I think people forget it wasn't all sunny side optimism. He warned of a country that had moved in the wrong direction. He talked about the economy of the 70s as really being debilitating and that we had lost our place in the world after Vietnam. That said, the whole message, the whole direction of what Reagan wanted to do was, in his mind and in the mind of many supporters and even opponents, a new vision, a new agenda, a new kind of market-based, conservative, principled revolution. President Trump doesn't really have that. It's more about the critique than the solution. And I think that's remained true right through to this day.
We have to talk about another phrase that was in the inaugural address and we've heard many times since, and that would be America first. Here he is.
From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
Now, on this one, Julian, many would say he has lived up to that. That has definitely been a very important point in his foreign policy.
He has. He's made a lot of progress. Look, on the domestic front, he's made a lot of progress in deregulating government. And on foreign policy, he has certainly severed or weakened our ties with allies and our place in the international community. The Paris Climate Agreement is something that is no longer what it was when he took office. Our relations with many allies are frayed as a result of the first year. And his rhetoric has been quite bellicose, and it has sent the consistent message that the United States will do what it needs to do based on its own interests. And so that America First principle is something that really is reshaping American foreign policy and has potentially long-term implications for our standing in the world.
So the president is scheduled to deliver his State of the Union address on January 30th. What are you expecting?
Well, he will say the State of the Union is good, and I don't think it will simply be a repeat of American carnage. He's now in a position where he wants to make sure the country understands the economy is doing well, and he will say he is the reason for the economy. But that bleak, darker part of President Trump will still be in that State of the Union speech. And I think on issues like immigration, those will be questions he puts front and center, warnings about what will go wrong if we don't give him the authority to tackle these underlying problems, the underlying illnesses that he sees in the country. And he will not soften on those kinds of positions.
And what do you make of the news that lawmakers, including Congressman John Lewis, are going to boycott the State of the Union?
Not a surprise. President Trump has not simply been a source of partisan division. He is much more than that. There are many Democrats and many Republicans who privately, at least, say he does not embody the values of the country. A lot of what he is saying is antithetical to where the nation should be in 2018. So I'm not surprised that there are some who will boycott. And on the issue of race, there is no issue other than immigration where he has been so divisive. And for an African-American representative who was injured severely in the marches of the civil rights movement of 1965, it makes sense that they might not want to be in the room for that State of the Union address.
That's Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. A new year has begun, and if you are setting new goals for your business, you need the right people on your team. And ZipRecruiter has transformed how you find them. ZipRecruiter posts your job to over 100 job boards with just one click, then actively looks for the most qualified candidates and invites them to apply. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Right now, listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Gun theft is rising across the country. The number of robberies of licensed firearm dealers has increased 227% since 2013. That's according to new data from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Mike Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us with more. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And that's a pretty surprising statistic. What's going on?
Oh, right. Yeah, some very alarming numbers in the story today from Bloomberg's Polly Mozens. First off, the number of guns stolen in robberies. So in other words, when someone actually sticks up a gun shop or a gun owner. And that number has tripled since 2013 to 288 guns last year, which is not a ton. But the much bigger number, what is much more common, is a burglary, when someone breaks into a gun shop or a home when no one is around or no one is awake. And those numbers have more than doubled since 2013 to more than 7,800 guns stolen last year through burglaries. And these are all based on thefts that were reported to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. So there likely are even more thefts out there that go unreported.
Does the Bureau offer any explanation for this uptick?
They're working on it, they say. An ATF spokeswoman quoted in the Bloomberg story said that they are actively looking into the data in order to identify the causation for the uptick in the crimes. But clearly, if you try to sort of think like a thief, it's easy to understand the appeal of guns. For one thing, guns aren't cheap. They can cost several hundred dollars to several thousand dollars. So if you burglarize a gun shop or a sporting goods store, you can make off with several at a time. And also, if you're a criminal who wants a firearm, buying a stolen gun obviously is more appealing because it can't be traced. So, my guess is that's likely part of the reason for the uptick.
Are there particular cities or regions where the increase has been greater, maybe places where it's easier to buy guns?
Well, if you look at the states with the highest number of guns stolen, southern states stick out at the top of the list. Texas had 769 guns stolen last year. And that's followed by Alabama, Georgia, Colorado, and Tennessee. Each of them had more than 400 guns stolen. Actually, Georgia showed a pretty big reduction in thefts. They had more than 1,000 guns stolen in 2016, so they've cut that number down by more than half.
Are there any steps that gun dealers or the government, by the way, could take to try to prevent these kind of crimes?
Well, so the ATF has a lot of guidelines for gun dealers on what they should do to secure their businesses, because most of these thefts are occurring at businesses rather than homes. And the ATF suggests everything from evaluating all the windows and entrances, even the walls and the ceilings of your gun shop, to screening employees, evaluating the store's surveillance cameras and alarm systems, protecting those security codes. But at this point, the ATF can do little more than basically offer these voluntary suggestions to gun stores. And there are some advocacy groups like the Center for American Progress who are calling on Congress to pass laws that would actually mandate security requirements for licensed gun dealers and give the ATF the authority to ensure compliance with them. So that's where the sort of advocacy groups are trying to take it.
Yeah, not sure I would hold my breath on that one, given that Congress couldn't even pass anything on bump stocks after the shooting in Las
Absolutely.
Vegas. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
We're going to have a conversation about how people communicate about what they want and don't want out of sex. The country is still talking about the lurid details of a date gone wrong with comedian Aziz Ansari. Last weekend, the website Babe published the account of a New York photographer who said she was the victim of unwanted and repeated sexual advances when she went on a date with Ansari back in September. The woman's supporters say her story is another example of men wielding their power to commit sexual violence. Others say the story was problematic and familiar in a completely different way. An example of a woman trying to navigate consent during yet another awkward and unsatisfying sexual encounter. Our next guest says that issue says something about the way young men and young women are taught about sex at an early age. Cindy Pierce speaks with college students about sexuality. She's written a book called Sexploitation, Helping Kids Develop Healthy Sexuality in a Porn-Driven World. Cindy, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Did I get that right? I mean, when you were thinking, what were you thinking when you heard the details of this story?
When the key word you said was awkward. And I think what really struck is that this is about miscommunication. And when so many people start their connections, as did these two individuals, through texting, that's when where a lot of flirting happens and what they think is getting more to know each other more. And when you're connected by phones, you're not, and through text, you're not really getting to know someone. So the whole hookup culture really stands out for me. It's just a recipe for misunderstanding and miscommunication. So I think both, you know, Aziz and this young woman, you know, had a hard time communicating and weren't reading each other's cues and weren't being clear. Now, so I think it's a complicated situation.
Right. In the woman's account, she says they met at a party and then the date was later arranged over the phone, as you mentioned. Look, some women hear this story and they say Ansari was sexually violent, and we're going to link people to the original story so they can read it. They can decide for themselves. It is a debate worth having. But there are other women who have been responding this week saying they don't see this as an assault. They say that this basically represents this broken sexual culture in America that leads men to either not understand or just not care about the cues or desires of a sexual partner. I mean, just like what's happening where that is so true for so many women?
I think it's really a collision of factors between the tolerated hookup culture, which is all about being casual. Also, adding to that, the social media, which keeps people at a distance, not practicing social courage. Social courage means you're going to be in awkward situations. You're going to have conflict. You're going to be, you know, having to negotiate things. But people aren't doing a lot of that. And in addition to that, porn, I think porn is a major factor. Porn is the number one sexuality educator. Parents kind of surrender because they think they put parental controls on it and they walk away from it, which kids work around. They think their kids are not online, where kids are curious and trying to get answers for things they hear on the bus or at recess or at school. Kids are being exposed to porn much earlier. Mm. The average age recently was 11. We're starting to hear that's 9 and something, you know, and in the trenches of talking to parents, it's really 9 or 8. And what they're exposed to, and it's not converting to their real experiences once they get to that point of having a partner. So I think between porn, hookup culture, and social media, that collision of factors, and you add alcohol to that, and it is just that's the recipe for disaster right there.
Again, people can go back and they can read the story for themselves if they haven't already. Some of the details are graphic, and I think, you know, just to be clear, that is what you're referring to when you say porn. I mean, that's many people were thinking what you just said when they read the report.
Right. I mean, I think that's where they get ideas. And the thing is, the porn industry is not going away. It owns the world. 30 to 35% what crosses the internet is porn globally, right? So, you know, I talk to young men in high school and college. I look like their auntie. They'll tell me anything. I'm no threat to their lives. They are concerned about porn. They are concerned how it's not converting to their sexual experiences. They're worried about erectile dysfunction. They're worried about the violence. Huh. Porn glorifies rape in a way. The most viewed porn is quite violent and quite aggressive, and it skews expectations about how bodies respond and how bodies look. Now, boys are really just – they're actually quite – the young men I speak to – almost all young men are interested in giving pleasure to their partners. They're interested in communicating and having a relationship. But the part they're scared of is the awkwardness of being the vulnerability required to make that happen. Mm. And so they depend on porn to get their ideas and kind of imitate that. And then it doesn't really pan out and they're confused.
You know what's so interesting about all of this is that Aziz Ansari was supposed to be aware of this problem. He talked publicly about feminism. He wrote a book about dating in the social media age. And yet afterwards, in response to this story, he said that he thought everything seemed okay, that they were having fun. Do you feel like there's a disconnect between the strides that, like, we're making as a culture with the Me Too movement and that sort of thing, empowering women, and then what we're actually seeing and doing behind closed doors?
I think we're in a time where we're still raising girls to be compliant, be polite. And for boys, there's still this pressure to prove your masculinity and your heterosexuality, whether you're heterosexual or not. And that is like your social survival for girls and boys. And I'm speaking in a very gendered, binary, you know, viewpoint here, because hookup culture is quite hyper-heterosexualized. And this is where a lot of the dynamic is. And it's about social survival.
You know, and there is this issue of consent. And taking this back again to the story about this date, the woman involved who did not use her full name said that she gave verbal and nonverbal cues to Aziz Ansari. And there are women who are saying that isn't enough. You should have just stood up and walked out of there if you didn't like what was going on. A really controversial point of view.
Right. Now, one thing, we're moving into a place where young people are starting to understand affirmative consent is verbal. It's not doing a checklist. It's checking in every step of the way. Whoever wants to advance to another level needs to ask. But we still have – now, in her situation, there was a power dynamic. But in her own account, I only heard once that she verbally said no. And Aziz Ansari responded, but then he continued to pursue her. So reading nonverbal cues, I hear this from people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s who expect, I just want my husband to know what I like. I want him to – I'm like, I'm sorry. These kinds of things are complicated. You got to give clear directions in sexually. And so not just around consent, but around pleasure and what you like. This needs to be clear and verbal. And people say, but it ruins the moment. And this is the most common thing you hear of people who have been violated, regardless of their gender, is that they were comfortable to a point. When they became uncomfortable and felt their boundaries were violated, they paused and didn't want it to be awkward. You often hear, I didn't want it to be awkward. I didn't want to hurt their feelings. Hmm. There's this pause. And in that pause, they are violated to a point where they are beyond uncomfortable. They're either assaulted or violated.
But you know,
in some way.
But you know what's tough about this conversation is that it's very difficult to have. I mean, it's difficult for me to sit here and have this conversation with you. It's difficult, I imagine, in the heat of a moment for two consensual partners to have that conversation. It's difficult for two people who have been in relationships for 20 years to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. So what are we to do, you know, especially as adults, because you're 23, you're 24, you're 25, you're out in the world, you're dating, you're not in college anymore. And then all of a sudden, you're just out there sort of on your own trying to navigate these situations.
You know, I think we need to keep saturating people with information. And this generation, they need it in surround sound. It cannot be, you know, a college student doesn't get one talk on affirmative consent and communication and get it. They need to be marinated in this message. And college is kind of the last place, because then you're off into Tinder world on your own. You know, we're in a very tricky time where communication is meant to be less of it, yet it's most needed. And I basically say to young people, if you can't talk about consent, pleasure, and you can't talk about contraception if you're in a heterosexual, you know, encounter, and you can't talk about safer sex using condoms and dental dams, if those four things, and people say, but that would be so awkward. I say, well, you're naked, and that's about as awkward as it gets. So if that feels too awkward, get your clothes back on.
Cindy Pierce speaks with college students about sex, and she's written a book called Sexploitation: Helping Kids Develop Healthy Sexuality in a Porn-Driven World. Cindy, thank you for the conversation. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
This is a big weekend for football. The NFL Conference Championship games will be played on Sunday night in the NFC. The Minnesota Vikings take on the Eagles in Philadelphia. Earlier in the day, the New England Patriots host the Jacksonville Jaguars in the AFC Championship. The winners go on to Super Bowl 52 on February 4th in Minneapolis. But not all of the team's players will be on the field come Sunday. I'm talking about the practice squad, which helps the team prepare for its next game. Their work week ends tomorrow, although they hope to impress the coach enough to earn a spot on the active roster. Shira Springer from member station WBUR has the story of one of the practice players for the Patriots.
The New England Patriots have just finished practicing, and the team's locker room is crowded with players, reporters, and cameramen. The media wait for big names like Tom Brady and Rob Gronkowski. About 40 feet away, an undersized offensive lineman quietly goes about his business.
My name is James Ference. I'm from Iowa City, Iowa. Played football at Iowa, and now I've been kicking around, trying to hang on, playing and chasing the dream.
That dream is a spot on the active roster of an NFL team, a chance to play in packed stadiums. But Ference says the Patriots' practice squad comes pretty close.
You know, you get to the NFL, and if you're not good enough to be on the 53-man roster, the next best thing is to be on a practice squad.
And that's where Ference is today. Just before the season began, Patriots coach Bill Belichick told Ference he wasn't good enough to make the active roster. But he also told Ference what skills he needed to improve to work his way up. In his uniquely terse way, here's what Belichick says about the Patriots practice squad players.
They do a great job. Yeah, they help us help the team prepare for the game. They improve their individual skills, and at some point, those players may be needed. But in any case, they develop their own skills.
The practice squad is a long way from where Ference was about 5 years ago. After playing for the University of Iowa, he was undrafted and went to work full-time in a carpet warehouse.
Yeah, it was a little shop called Randy's Carpets down in Coralville, Iowa. We did everything from driving the forklifts around, loading up tile, to, you know, cutting carpet and helping installers take it to a job site. I mean, it was a lot of manual labor, but I worked with a lot of really good guys who really made the job enjoyable.
The job also gave Ference perspective and flexible hours. He kept training for the NFL and earned a spot on the Houston Texans practice squad. Later, a Super Bowl title while on the Denver Broncos active roster back in 2016. Eventually, the Broncos let Ference go. Now he's on the Patriots practice squad, and he considers himself lucky.
You know, you could be on the street versus being on a practice squad, and that's that's week to week, too. So that's something you're fighting for your job every week still, and you know, guys on the practice squad, we're not good enough right now, so we're still trying to improve. We'll give a good look. So, you know, it's an opportunity to just keep competing and keep improving. As canned as that is, it's really the truth of what we're doing. We're just trying to improve and give ourselves an opportunity to play.
If it sounds like Ferentz is speaking for practice squad players across the NFL, he kind of is. His career is a lot like the careers of hundreds of others in the same position. They go to all the same meetings as the active roster players. They're on the field for all the practices, just not for games. And practice squad players earn much smaller paychecks. Their minimum weekly pay is $7,200. The minimum weekly pay for a roster player is just over $27,000. The average NFL player earns about $120,000 a week. But Ferentz says it's not about the money.
You know, I think there's a lot of success stories out there of guys who've gone from practice squad to active roster. And, you know, and if you lose sight of that, I think you lose a step, you don't improve, and then you end up back out on the street and nobody wants to be there.
In the Patriots locker room, there's one of those success stories. Wide receiver Danny Amendola began his NFL career on practice squads in Dallas, then Philadelphia. That's where he was when the then St. Louis Rams claimed him for their active roster.
Yeah, I definitely shed a tear and started packing my bags, very thankful for the opportunity that I was undrafted, so it's something that I'll always, you know, have that chip on my shoulder and you know, I'll never forget.
When Amendola takes the field against the Jaguars on Sunday as one of the NFL's top receivers, Ferentz will be watching from home with his wife and one-year-old son.
You know, you watch it at home, and you're right there with them with, you know, every play. You know, your heart's with the team, and just hope for the best come Sunday, and you hope that you did your job well enough that they felt prepared.
Most of all, Ferentz hopes to be back at work next week, practicing for the Super Bowl. For Here and Now, I'm Shira Springer.
And some airline news to close out the hour. A record quick journey from New York to London on a Norwegian Airlines flight. It made the trip, Peter, earlier this week in 5 hours and 13 minutes. That is the fastest subsonic transatlantic flight recorded on a commercial aircraft. It beat a British Airways flight by 3 minutes thanks to a 202 mile per hour tailwind. And meanwhile, Delta is saying today it's going to be more thorough in its vetting of emotional support animals on flights. It says customers have tried to fly with comfort turkeys, gliding possums, snakes, and spiders, not just cute yellow labs. Delta flies 700 service animals a day. That's 150% increase since 2015.
Can I still bring my chihuahua?
I think so. That's an emotional support. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.